Welcome to this wet and now snowy version of Main Street here on Prairie Public on this Wednesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we are glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, Prairie Beat. It takes a look at measles and what's driving renewed concern, how it spreads, and what families across the region should know. And a bit later, geothermal rising. Experts explain how next-generation geothermal, including repurposed oil wells, could deliver reliable, around-the-clock, clean power and reshape the energy mix right here in North Dakota before a testimony next week at a legislative committee hearing. But we begin Main Street today with Prairie Plates.
This is another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public. This is your host, Rick Eon, and we're going to be talking a little bit about burgers today again and Indian food and the merger of two and a winning championship belt in downtown Bismarck. And I have with me today Surjit Saroya of India Clay Oven in downtown Bismarck. Surjit, thanks for being on with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your radio station, sir.
Yeah, you're welcome. So I've been to India Clay Oven numerous times. Usually it's for the lunch buffet as I'm going through Bismarck on my way to southwestern North Dakota. And it's one of my favorite restaurants in the state. It just is.
Thank you so much for that.
And you've recently won, I think, a well-deserved championship belt, a prize for the Downtown Bismarck Burger Slam for the Maharaja Burger, and it's kind of a people's choice competition, and we had Don Kopp on recently with the Bismarck Downtowners, and she described the competition earlier in January, and it's an event early in January every year, I think for the last 3 years, just to promote downtown and drum up some business for different restaurants downtown, but it's a people's choice competition. They vote through an app. The categories are patty, bun, toppings, creativity, service. But I'm having Surjit on today to talk about the burger and his food at India Clay Oven, which I didn't get to try any of these burgers, but I think you should send one to Fargo, Surjit.
I will, for sure, sir. You have to come down in Bismarck to try that because it feels and tastes very good when you're trying in person and it's fresh. We make it fresh, you know?
Yeah, describe the burger a little bit more. I have a description here, and it looks just absolutely delicious, but talk about that burger a little bit.
Okay, it's called Maharaja Lamb Burger, and it's made by fresh ground lamb with mint, cilantro, and some touch of Indian spices, filled with cheese, and the bun with the jalapeno cheese, cheddar cheese, then tomato, fresh tomatoes, onions, and fresh lettuce, and a homemade mayonnaise with little spiciness, spicy mayonnaise sauce that people liked a lot. Actually, we did not expect it, that they will like it. And that is a Maharaja lamb burger. And we do fries with it, and they are made fresh by fresh potatoes and the touch of chili flakes. And I think we are surprised people liked it a lot.
Well, obviously they did, and again, I need to try this burger because I love the spice flavors of Indian food, cumin, coriander, that sort of thing, cilantro. All of those things are just, not only are they delicious, but they're healthy. Well, describe what the Burger Slam win means for India Clay Oven.
So thanks to Don Kopp, and this is our first year. We recently joined Bismarck Downtown Association, you know. Then she introduced that competition to us because every restaurant in downtown, they were doing that, you know. So all the main restaurants on Main Street and around it. So we did join it, and we were not expecting this much love from Bismarck people that they will love it, the burger. So we did join that competition, and then we did couple trials to make the burger because that's not our main cuisine, you know. We can do it, but this was our first time doing it.
So this was the first time you've entered into the Burger Slam?
Yes, sir. And luckily we won it.
Yeah, one and done. Are you going to display the championship belt? It's a WWE wrestling style belt.
Yeah, it's already there, sir. It's already on the wall. We framed it and we put it on the wall. So everybody who will enter the restaurant, they will see it.
Well, I think it's fun and it's something to be definitely proud of for the quality of food and service at India Clay Oven. And how many of these Maharaja burgers did you sell?
We almost sold like 200 burgers in 1 month.
Wow. So that really helps your business.
Yes. And everybody rated it above 9.0, like 9 out of 10. So that's our rating to win it.
And again, that's on patty, bun, toppings, creativity. And I really think service, that's a part of the competition too. And I think your restaurant really stands out with service. You really have some good employees there.
Yeah, we tried our best, sir. We do always. And we try our best to give everybody, whoever comes into the restaurant, we try to give them feel like they are at home, you know, having dinner at their home. And we try to do our best.
Well, Sergey, let's talk a little bit about yourself. What's your history in food service or restaurant industry? How did you get involved in starting India Clay Oven?
I'm from Missouri, Branson, Missouri. I do have another location over there, and that is taken care of by my family now, my dad, my two brothers. So we started our journey from Missouri. We started in 2015, I think. So we opened up a restaurant over there. We got too much love over there. And then I had a friend over here in Bismarck. He said, there is no restaurant in Bismarck, Indian restaurant, actually. So I decided to come over here. I look around, and then we find a spot in Bismarck downtown. And we decided to open up over there. And here we are. It's been like 5 years so far, and we got great response from everybody, whoever comes in, and all the people of whole community in Bismarck. They gave us too much love, and we appreciate that, and keep supporting us and keep loving us, and we will try to serve you guys best food and fresh food, great service.
Do you really enjoy cooking? Did you get into that at an early age, or serving people in a restaurant?
Yeah, so that was actually my hobby, to cook the food. And then I decided to do as a professional. Then I learned from people's, like, their recipes. Then I improvised them, you know. Then I cook by myself. I did, like, when we opened this restaurant, I did cooking here for 2 years. Now I work around, you know, help everybody front, then in the kitchen. So that's how he does.
Well, Sergey, tell us a little bit about your restaurant, or a lot about your restaurant in downtown Bismarck. I really enjoyed my visits there.
So India Clay Oven is located in Bismarck downtown at 510 East Main Avenue on Main Street. So we do lunch buffet every day from Tuesday to Sunday, then 5 to 10 dinner. In the buffet, if somebody comes, they can try, you know, a lot of things like curries, bread, then appetizers, dessert, salad. So it's a good price. Also, it's $18.99 plus tax. And you guys can come in and enjoy the buffet, so you know what you like, you know. So whoever is not, haven't tried Indian food yet in Bismarck, please come in and enjoy. And you can know what you like from the buffet. Otherwise, whenever you come in dinner, we do have very good staff who tell you guys, to help you guys, what to choose, what you guys like. And also, people does have in their mind, like, Indian food is a little spicy. That is not true. We do create and make your food according to your taste, according to your preference, and according what spice level you guys like. So that's how we cook it. So don't be afraid and come in, enjoy, and we are there to help you guys.
Custom crafted food, I love it.
Yes, sir. It's not like pre-made food, whatever you guys, you can see like after you come, after you order, that plate will come on your table. It will describe itself, you know, it's made only for you.
Well, one thing I love about Indian food is there's just a really fun base of things to cook, browning the onions, ginger, garlic paste, the different spices, cumin, coriander, all of those things. And you really do it right. Tell us a little more about your menu.
Okay, so we have a big variety of dishes in our menu, starting from appetizers, breads, sides, chicken dishes, veggie dishes, lamb dishes, seafood dishes like shrimp and fish. And also we do have the meat mixed with rice. It's called biryani in India.
Yes.
So that's like fried rice, but not exactly fried rice. It's kind of that. So choosing your own meat, whatever you like, we mix with the spices and onions and the rice and with mint, fresh mint and cilantro. That's called biryani. People like that a lot. It's a very good dish. And then we have desserts, you know. So we do have a big variety of dishes. It's for everybody. Whoever's like, whatever they like, we can cook it.
And one of my questions on my notes here, there are different regional foods of India for the different areas of the country, but it sounds like you're taking more of an approach that's comprehensive, that just gives a feel for the whole country.
We try to cover, like, I do only two cuisines, to be honest with you, like Middle Eastern and then the north side of India. So I'm from Punjab, so my more forte is like Punjabi cuisine. So there is South Indian cuisines also, but I don't do that. I can cook that, but I don't have that audience over here who does like that. It's a little spicy. Their food is very spicy, so that's why.
Well, you mentioned biryani, which I really like, and there's saffron involved in that too, which I really enjoy.
Yes, it is, sir. It does have saffron in it.
And are there some things that you're most proud of on your menu or you really like to make for your customers?
So our most popular dishes are butter chicken, chicken tikka masala, and tandoori chicken, and all the breads we have in our menu, and some appetizers also. So what the most selling item in our restaurant is butter chicken. So that is tomato-based gravy with chicken and creamy sauce. So it's combination of tomatoes, chicken, cream, and fenugreek. So it's very good. People like it a lot.
I love fenugreek. I put it in a Persian salad with some dried mint and use it in Indian cooking too. And the seeds are good, but methi, the leaves dried or fresh can be quite good too. And that's that really interesting earthy scent when you walk into an Indian restaurant.
Yes, it is.
Well, you also have a bar in your restaurant. Let's talk about that a little bit. It's a very nice bar, very welcoming. Are there any specialty drinks or cocktails you'd like to talk about?
We do have full bar, and we do our own handcrafted cocktails also. So it's you guys can come in and enjoy that. We do have fresh-made margaritas. Then we create our own spice tequila. We spice them like with fresh ingredients like cinnamon, star anise, fresh chilies. So it's like spice. We can make spice mule out of it, spice margaritas out of it. Whatever you like, we can do it.
Well, that sounds really good, and I might make for a good evening in the capital city there in Bismarck. Again, Sergeet, what is your location and the hours of operation of India Clay Oven?
So location is in Bismarck downtown, 510 East Main Avenue on Main Street. When you come into downtown, we are under the bar of Luft and Speakeasy. Then next door we have Peacock Alley. So we are under that building. You will see us. And we do lunch buffet every day from Tuesday to Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2:30 and dinner from 5 to 10. I do encourage people, please come in and try our lunch buffet. It's a good price and good value. You will like the buffet and also try a lot of different things. Then you know what you like.
Saroya of India Clay Oven in downtown Bismarck, thanks for being with us today, and congratulations on the big Burger Slam win.
Thank you so much, sir, for having me on your radio station, and I do thank and appreciate all community around Bismarck and in Bismarck. Thanks for your love and support, and keep supporting us, and we are here.
This is the latest edition of Prairie Plates. I'm your host, Rick Guillen. We'll talk to you next week. On the road. Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire, providing live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery for in-person, hybrid, and virtual events. Serving clients throughout the Upper Midwest and nationwide. More at livewirenow.com.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. People in the northeast corner of North Dakota are facing more cases of a disease once thought to be eradicated in this country. Here's more from our news podcast, Prairie Beat.
Howdy ho, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thanks for joining us again this week for another episode of Prairie Beat.
If you're new to it, it's our weekly news podcast here at Prairie Public. Oh, Danielle, what's up this week?
Well, this week we're just going to jump right in because, you know, we got to get to this before anything else happens. There's been a few more measles cases confirmed by the State Department of Health and Human Services.
Yeah, it just, I don't know. I can't believe we're revisiting this, but I mean, there are a lot of states that are going through this right now, and North Dakota is one of them, but it just seems like one of those highly preventable things.
So yes, the last couple of years, there's been significant outbreaks of measles. Last year, North Dakota actually had the highest rate of positive measles cases per 100,000 people, with 36 confirmed cases in the state. And then it just sort of stopped for a while. And then at the beginning of this month, on February 3rd, one singular case of measles was confirmed in Williams County. And that's actually where a lot of the outbreak happened last year.
Yeah, I remember that. A couple hundred kids had to stay home from school to quarantine, right?
Yes, they did. And since that first case on February 3rd, over the past week and a half, specifically, six additional cases were confirmed. And they were actually confirmed in Pembina County. Now, that's on the opposite side of the state from Williams County. It's up in the northeasternmost corner of North Dakota. So I got on the horn this morning with Health and Human Services.
Molly Howell, Director of Disease Control and Forensic Pathology for the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services.
I started out by asking Molly Howell to just give me a general update on what's been going on with this outbreak of seven total so far.
Four of those cases have been unvaccinated, two fully vaccinated, and one has an unknown vaccination status, and two individuals have been hospitalized.
Well, that's really interesting. I know that the measles or MMR vaccine is pretty effective, so it's a little jarring, I must say, to hear that at least two of these patients had in fact been vaccinated.
So after one dose, it's 93% effective, and after two doses, 97% effective, but it's not 100% effective. So that means 97% effective means that 3 out of 100 vaccinated individuals who are exposed to measles will go on to develop measles.
Okay, I mean, yeah, I guess that makes sense. But it does seem like out of the positive pool so far, the breakthrough rate is a little inflated.
There are other things that can be at play here, too. She told me that if someone is immunocompromised, it can affect how the effectiveness of the vaccine is. And she also mentioned that there was a period of time in the 1960s where there was an inactivated vaccine series that wasn't as effective as the live series. So those folks might have had that vaccine. And last year, none of the 36 people who did test positive for measles were vaccinated. So those were all unvaccinated people last year. And one other thing that was interesting about this outbreak is that of these seven current positive cases, five are adults. One case is a child under 5. The other is a child between 5 and 19. But all the other cases are adults over the age of 20.
Huh. Well, I'd have to imagine that after a cluster of positive cases being identified and how contagious, absolutely amazingly contagious, not in a good way, this virus is, I mean, there's got to be more measles circulating out there that we just don't know about.
Correct. And she did tell me that. HHS does a lot of interviewing during an outbreak so they can notify people who may have been exposed directly and then warn the public of any places that they may have been where there was an exposure. And this is because, like we just said, you know, measles is super contagious. It's airborne. It can linger for hours. And she says that from what they can gather, there probably are other cases out there that just either aren't coming in for testing or they haven't been identified yet.
Yeah, I think that there is a fairly high likelihood that we will have additional cases.
The incubation period is about 7 to 14 days, and symptoms can develop about 10 to 12 days after exposure. And if you go to the measles dashboard on the Health and Human Services website, they actually have a list of public places of exposure that you can look at. It's way too long to actually list here. So you can look there, check to see if you've been anywhere that you could have been exposed to measles. And if you have and you're not vaccinated, it's recommended that you quarantine, stay home for 21 days to prevent it from spreading further.
There's a lot of variables that go into, you know, an outbreak and how long it will last or how many cases you'll see. And it's really up to the community to decide that. If you have high rates of measles vaccination, then you're going to be less likely to have an outbreak or less likely to have more cases. For measles, because it is so contagious, you really need a 95% vaccination rate to prevent the spread.
Molly Howell said it's also highly dependent on people getting tested and cooperating with public health during those interviews, providing information on contacts, where they've been, all that stuff.
Danielle, do you know what the current vaccination rate is in North Dakota for measles? Because that has been an issue for a while now. Declining public trust in vaccines has led to falling vaccination rates that go hand in hand and thus higher rates of disease.
Molly Howell told me that last year's kindergarten vaccination rate for MMR was just about 90%. So that is pretty good, yeah. But it's not that 95% that they like to see that kind of keeps the, what they like to call it, a herd immunity up. But Pembina County actually does have, she said, a 95% vaccination rate.
Yeah, it's kind of out of the two corners, northwest and northeast, are the ones that are having the outbreak issues.
If I remember correctly now, the first case in Pembina County was actually, they acquired it from the contact in Williams County, I believe so.
Well, yes. And getting back to the early COVID days, right? Contact tracing. I wonder how much of that is going on right now.
A lot. She also reminded me that after last year's outbreak, there was more interest in the MMR vaccine. So parents who maybe hadn't vaccinated their kids yet were showing up, starting to do that, or at least asking about it. And she also said that in Pembina County, they're recommending accelerated and early vaccination too, so that can help get more people protected.
All right, then, Pembina County, we're looking at you. Place to watch, I guess.
The list of exposure locations on the website had a lot of spots listed in Cavalier, but I also saw Grand Forks, Fargo, Walhalla, and even Colfax was on there, too. So if you're in those communities, it couldn't hurt to just check that out and see if you've been in at any of those places. And one last thing, Molly Howell did mention that for folks who are interested in the MMR vaccine, it's widely available at primary care providers, public health units all over the place. And there are no barriers or anything keeping those vaccines from anybody who wants them. There's no cost, nothing. So she recommends folks talk to their doctor about that.
Well, already then, as usual, we'll be keeping a sharp eye on this developing story here at Prairie Public. Thanks for all that, Danielle. What else is going on in the state of things in North Dakota this week?
Trade is not something that happens overnight. You have to spend years building relationships and making contacts and developing a trust with trading partners.
Well, we ran a Harvest Public Media story about Congress voting to repeal President Trump's tariffs on Canada. There's a lot of agricultural interests on that.
I am very impressed with a significant number of the candidates.
The North Dakota University System is working on finding three new college presidents. And police in Fargo are still looking for Isadora Wengel's remains. She's the young woman who went missing last month from West Fargo.
We now find ourselves in the midst of a midwinter thaw, which may reveal her whereabouts.
Public searches have been organized, and those efforts are ongoing. Her boyfriend has been charged with her murder.
Yeah, I know her father thanked volunteers who were out in near downtown Fargo last week, and they're doing another search in Otter Tail County this weekend. So, awful, awful story. Very, very tragic. Hopefully you resolve soon. Okay, Danielle, thanks for all that.
Yeah, absolutely. Be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more news or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
All right, that'll do it for this week's Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
You can find Prairie Beat wherever you get your podcast. Make sure to subscribe and like it, or you can listen at prairiepublic.org. New episodes drop each Wednesday. Still to come on Main Street, geothermal energy. It's right under our feet here in North Dakota, and experts will let us know how it could deliver reliable, around-the-clock, clean power and reshape the energy mix right here in the Peace Garden State. That's ahead. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we often think of clean energy as weather dependent. Solar when it's sunny, maybe wind when it's breezy, but geothermal draws on a constant heat that's beneath our feet. And in the past 2 years, next generation geothermal has shifted from interesting to investable with federal cost targets and rising demand for 24/7 carbon-free power driving momentum. Today, we look at enhanced geothermal systems, advanced drilling, and the possibility that former oil and gas wells could become part of the clean energy future. Joining us are Paul Jensen, president of Greenway Energy, and Dr. Munis Almute. She's a UND engineer and CEO of GeoTinkers. They'll help us separate promise from hype and explore what it could take to scale geothermal in places like North Dakota. And they're visiting with us in front of their testimony next Thursday at the Energy Development and Transmission Committee meeting of the North Dakota Legislature. Paul and Dr. Almute, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Dr. Almute, let me just begin with you first. When people hear next generation geothermal, what are we actually talking about?
So that's a very great question. So you know that typically people may have like a little bit of hard time to understand what the geothermal is. So first, we need to give a good definition of what the geothermal energy is so that then they can get a good understanding of what next geo is actually. So we can think about like the Earth as like, let's say, a very giant heat engine. And as you go deeper under the ground, temperature starts increasing because of the residual heat that we have from the planet's formation. And of course, the ongoing type of a decay of the radioactive element that we have in the crust. So let's say in North Dakota's Williston Basin, the temperature increased roughly about 20 up to 35 degrees Celsius for every kilometer that we drill down. So to harness that heat, we drill the wells into the hot rock formation, or let's say hot aquifer, then circulate the water or use some naturally occurring hot brine that are already down there to bring down thermal energy to the surface. So once that energy is at the surface, the hot fluid, let's say 120 up to 160 degrees Celsius, we can go to two routes. For electricity generation, we can try to flow that through the binary organic Rankine cycle that we have, which we call that the ORC power plant, but it passes through a heat exchanger and then transfer the heat to the secondary working fluid that has a much lower boiling point than the water. So that working fluid starts vaporizing, spinning the turbine, generating the electricity, and then we can condense it back to the liquid, and then the cycle repeat and repeat while we are trying to cool down the geothermal brine and get it pumping back to an injection well to be reheated by the earth, right? So that, which creates a closed loop. We also can have like a direct use, which is even simpler. We can skip the electricity conversion entirely, just pipe that hot fluid directly to where we need that. For example, if you want to do the greenhouse, if you want to do the grain dryer, if you are trying to think about the aquaculture, district heating system, or let's say any type of industrial process that we have. Either way, the beautiful thing is that Earth keeps that reheating fluid, that resource available for 24/7 regardless of the weather, and we can producing that energy with near zero emission. So enhanced geothermal system is just like another type of a system, so that it means like that even if you have like one of those options available, like let's say high temperature or like let's say the fracture that those heat coming to the surface, when we do not have that, we can improve the system so we can get the heat of the system out of the system. So when we are talking about next geo, it means that we are developing our technology in that case that we can still with like let's say low temperature, with having like low fracture over there, with low fluid that can actually carry that heat, we still can develop the technology so we can get the heat and harness that heat for electricity generation or direct use.
So before I move to you, Paul, I want to ask, is this source everywhere, or are there some geologic formations that are better suited and perhaps less expensive to harness this geothermal energy, and especially here in the state? And I'm wondering specifically about oil wells.
Sure, that is a very great question. First of all, I can say it's available everywhere, but of course, if you are closer to the places or the geological formation that you can get access to the high temperature that you have over there, and of course, you have like a better geology over there regarding like the permeability, the fracture networking that you have over there, probably the cost would be much more cheaper to you. And of course, in the western part of North Dakota, looking at all the global heat flow map that we have available, we would observe like that all those places that we have the oil and gas, we have also high potential for geothermal development.
Paul, from your perspective, what makes geothermal different from wind and solar when it comes to keeping the lights on? Is it the reliability, the ability to run around the clock, or is it something different?
No, it's definitely the reliability, the fact that you can generate base load almost, is it 95% of the time? You do have some downtime for maintenance and stuff like that, but other than that, you have base load generation at any given point in time. And that's what the weakness is on wind and solar, is that it is intermittent. We measure this in something we call capacity factors. And for wind and solar, for wind, it's about 42%. Geothermal, it's more like 95%, as I said earlier. And so this makes it a really good and viable support and complementary energy source, specifically for the ambitions that we have in our state to build out more AI data processing plants. When I looked at the requirement that we have, it's about 2.3 gigawatt of installed capacity, generation capacity. And there's no way that we can do this just on wind and solar unless you cover the whole state. But still, you need to have some kind of a storage. And obviously, in geothermal, our storage is the energy in the earth, which is unending, at least for the next 4 billion years. And as such, I mean, we never have a discussion on energy sources or dependability, reliability. It's just always going to be there.
It's surprising to me, quite frankly, that we haven't heard more about geothermal prior to this. So much discussion about solar, so much discussion about wind. But it's my understanding that federal researchers often say that drilling is the biggest cost and risk to geothermal. So what are we seeing as far as the biggest improvements right now that are making this perhaps in its time to scale? Are we drilling faster? Are we underground mapping better? Are we monitoring more smartly?
This is a very great question, because you know that 30 to 57% of like a total geothermal project cost goes to the drilling, and the technology has a huge impact on that. Like Fervo Energy and Utah showed that the oil and gas drilling technique, specifically what we have for PDC bead or horizontal drilling, multiple pad drilling, all of them can reduce the geothermal drilling costs by 12 to up to 26%. And there is a study done by the National Renewable Energy Lab that it shows like the cost curve that have been updated, and it shifted because of like the average rate that we have for the penetration, that it's improved from like, let's say 25 feet per hour up to 75 feet per hour. And going back to North Dakota, the states has like a very mature oil and gas drilling infrastructure. So we have a very experienced workforce. We have like some existing rig available for us that it provide a cost advantage. So drilling contractor, they're familiar with the Bakken. They can transfer those skill sets directly to the geothermal operation. So one option over here is just repurposing those abundant oil and gas that we have available in North Dakota. So reusing those abundant wellbore, that could reduce the upfront cost up to 50 to 80%, which potentially bring the cost about $500K to $1.5 million per any converted well, versus, let's say, if you are doing the one new deep well, about like $5 million.
So what are the risks then? I mean, this sounds very efficient. It sounds somewhat easy from the aspect of we're so good at drilling for oil. What can go wrong?
You know that North Dakota actually geologically is located in a very good place. So when it comes to some places, usually like the seismic activity would be a huge problem. So and at the moment, even that's not a big deal, because for those states, including, for example, California or Nevada or Arizona, those places that they are prone to the earthquake, they have the seismic mitigation plan ahead of doing the whole project. Here in North Dakota, we are not close to any active plate. So we do not have like any risk of getting like, let's say, any earthquake when we are doing the drilling. So in that regard, we do not have any problem. Plus to that, most of the time, the problem coming to the fact like that, how we are taking care of our pipeline is still with the technology that we have, we can take care of that because there are so many available solution available for us, like including chemical treating the well bore. We have like the pipeline intervention gadget devices that can go and clean up the pipeline as well. So any of, like, let's say, risk associated with doing the whole project has been already addressed by the new technology that are coming to the scenario. And every day you see like some new devices and some new technology that have been introduced and would be tested in some of like the project that we have as an ongoing project around specifically in the United States.
Paul, this one's for you. How would this fit into the grid? We certainly know how our grid works today. Relatively centralized with massive coal or maybe natural gas-fired power plants. Obviously, there's new research with nuclear. But how would this fit into the grid in your eyes?
Well, as I think everybody knows, that the electrons will travel the shortest way to a load. So this means that when you generate energy in the megawatt range, you want to inject it at a high voltage level, so that it can spread out through the high voltage grid to lower voltage levels and eventually to the end users. But clearly in this case here, we are going to look at 6 or 7 large data processing centers that use a lot of energy, and they would also use a lot of cooling water, something that we actually are addressing in the subject of geothermal energy. So it would be good to have it close by, a data processing plant. As you can imagine, injecting into the grid predominantly at a high voltage is desirable. From that level, you know, you can integrate with the Southern Power Pool, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. And whenever we don't have the full need of energy in the state, we could export it and add to the revenues of the state. We can export to other neighboring states. And by such, we are actually supporting the grid to become more stable. Stability of the grid is very, very important, especially in inclement weather situations.
Enjoying my conversation with Paul Jensen, the president of Greenway Energy, and Dr. Munis Almuti. She's a UND engineer and CEO of GeoTinkers, and we're talking about enhanced geothermal systems in front of their testimony next week before the North Dakota legislature. Explain to me the federal government's involvement here. It seems that they're backing away from the use of renewables and recommitting to fossil fuels. How does that interject with what you're planning?
We're happy to say that geothermal is part of the president's statement on, was it January the 20th last year, in which he says that geothermal would be forming part of the generation portfolio for the country. So this, although this is renewable, it is not a intermittent power generation source. It is base load, and that's what he's thinking about when he wants to have a stable grid. It's base load, and that is what geothermal offers. So you have to look at it in that light, that it is a base load source.
Dr. Alamuti, give us the time frame that you are considering for a project like this. In other words, how long might it be before this truly becomes scalable for, let's say, a working data center here in North Dakota?
That's a very great question. And I guess that it comes to the fact like that, how long did it take time for us to finish this geothermal study build? Because this is like a actually foundation for what is needed to be done. So if we can do the geothermal pass through this geothermal study, when we are done with that, we can get a good picture of where we can actually put our geothermal power plant. And then there's like a group of people, engineers, scientists, specifically around the state, of course, University of North Dakota, NUS, and other research institutions, that they can collaborate with each other. And then they can actually show the roadmap of the things that are needed or the steps that we needed to take to actually do our power plant. But beforehand, we have to get a good picture of like what is needed to be done, how much of like, let's say, geology we have over there. Usually what would happen is just like that, any average geothermal power plant required about like 5.5 years from like, let's say, securing the permit or the license that they need to the final commissioning, which still is the problem because it may take range from 4 to 7 years. But again, if you have that, then you can, in the process of like just getting like the permission and getting like the commission and et cetera, to actually build your entire project.
You're both testifying before the state legislative committee next week. What are you asking them for? What does the state need to do to help this project along?
They really have to get going very quickly on allocating funds for this study. This study will be sort of the sales presentation material to invite corporations to come and invest in our state. And so we can't get it done fast enough, honestly. Bearing in mind what Dr. explained earlier is that it's quite a long lead time. And that's for all equipment nowadays. I can tell you, gas turbines, steam turbines, also have a 4 to 5 year lead time. And transformers for power stations have a significant lead time. So even if the data centers could find some used gas turbine and some used transformers, yeah, it would hold them over for a while, but delivery times are long. So we cannot sit and wait any longer. We really must take a decision where we're going to go forward. And with geothermal, we are independent from any price fluctuation on fossil fuels around the world, be that natural gas or oil. And as such, we have a stable, financeable generation source for a long time to come.
Is that both of your beliefs that geothermal energy is cost competitive as it's understood today with what we come to understand from gas and coal?
Sure, I guess that's the thing. So I believe like that this is like one of the cost competitive when it comes to like, let's say, when you're comparing that with the renewable at least energy. And as I guess that Paul mentioned, when it comes to the renewable energy, they all have like the intermittency issues, but that's not the case for
sure.
the geothermal energy. And plus to that, the footprint that the geothermal causes is not comparable to what the other renewable energy resources does have. Yeah. So I believe like that, first of all, the megawatt output that we can get per well, the costs that we need for the maintenance and et cetera, it's actually high competitive with like other energy resources that we have available.
As we wind up our conversation, let me ask each of you, and Dr. Alamutu, I'll ask you first. If listeners can remember just one thing about geothermal now, what should it be?
It should be the reliability and energy security. And thinking about that, you can think about like having that energy resource available for you 24/7 available. And think about like in a state like North Dakota that we always are suffering from, like they say, harsh winter, and we are always scared of like getting like the power outage. That wouldn't be any case anymore if we can get the geothermal energy accessible for ourselves. Yeah. You know that we can have a system that the multiple geothermal plants work together. Like, for example, we can have a distributed portfolio. Let's say we have 5 to 10 plants of, like, I don't know, 5 to 30 megawatts. And they could be, like, across the high heat flow zone that we have in the western North Dakota. And rather than, let's say, having, like, one giant facility. So each of them would be connected to the nearest transmission point that we have. So MISO can aggregate and dispatch them as a part of the regional generation mix. So that distributed approach also adds the resilience. So, for example, if we are doing the maintenance in one plant and that plant is down, the others keeps running, which also would be an advantage.
Paul, what would you like listeners to take away from our conversation?
Yeah, well, that the reliability is so important. The known costs and financing of the projects is predictable. And I think the reliability and predictability is really of great importance for an electric power grid. Already at this point in time, the USGS has estimated that we have about 49 gigawatt potential to extract from the underground of North Dakota. Our current consumption is about 9 gigawatt. And as you can see, there's room for an enormous expansion. And even with the added AI data centers, well, we expect that they will bring a demand of 2.3 gigawatt to the whole portfolio. But as you can see, with a potential of 49 gigawatt, we have abundant resources, and we just need to get our act in gear. You know, really just get moving, because we can't sit and wait. And I'm afraid that that's what we're doing in many cases.
In order to do the study efficiently,
What kind of resources from the state, dollar-wise, are you seeking?
That's a very great question. If you compare that with like other state and what they are doing, they usually pull like around like $1 to $5 million for doing this kind of a project. I don't know if that would be the budget that the state is looking for, but this is just like a typically the thing that they would dedicate to do the study, because it goes from like, let's say, surface up to underground, the subsurface, to getting making sure that we have everything ready to build our pilot project.
Well, certainly the need for electricity is going to grow almost exponentially, and geothermal systems perhaps can be a part of it. And we've appreciated the conversation today with Paul Jensen, president of Greenway Energy, and Dr. Munis from the University of North Dakota, where she's an engineer and also CEO of GeoTinkers. Thank you both for clearing a lot of things up for us, and best wishes with your endeavors.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity to be on your show.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents A Night at the Oscars, February 21st at the Fargo Theater. Conducted by Jane Lind Capistran, the program features the FM choral artists with music from Oscar-winning films. Information at fmsymphony.org. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, helping families reach their dreams throughout the Bismarck-Mandan area. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 18th. On this date, in 1797, fur trader Chaboyes of the Northwest Company recorded the arrival of Animikans, Little Thunder, at the Pembina Fur Trade Post. Little Thunder was hired to guide personnel to the Souris River to obtain supplies for the Pembina Post from trader McDonald. The crew was instructed to return their guide to Pembina in the spring. However, the next day, Little Thunder changed his mind about the job when Chaboyes refused to advance him any pay. Native hunters were not post employees, but free agents pursuing their seasonal round of activity. They might do business elsewhere if it was profitable. The Souris River Basin was integral to the fur trade. An abundant variety of wildlife and furred game existed there, and the fertile grazing areas supported great herds of bison. The production and supply of pemmican powered the rest of the fur trade. During the fur trade era, 18 posts owned by independent traders as well as companies operated in the Souris Basin between present-day Souris, Manitoba, and Minot, North Dakota. The first Souris River Post was established by the Hudson's Bay Company in 1766. Ash House was established there by the Northwest Company in 1795. Rival traders often built posts at the same locations as their competition. This was the case at Pembina in 1797. After the next year's fur season, Chaboyes abandoned the Pembina post. Alexander Henry arrived in 1800 to renew the Northwest Company trade at Pembina. He came from Leech Lake in Minnesota with a canoe brigade of hunters led by Old Wild Rice, the pillager chief and father of Little Thunder. Chaboyes had previously traded with Old Menominee, whom he called the Great Chief, meaning he had influence among a band of men who were themselves tent leaders. Wild Rice directed the seasonal round of activities of the Pembina Band, including 10 hunting tents of his own. Chaboyes formally negotiated with him when matters of religious ceremony or warfare with the Dakota people might curtail trade activity. Nevertheless, Wild Rice traded with the Hudson's Bay Company if the profit was better. The Hudson's Bay Company monopoly was granted by the British Crown in 1670 and dominated the fur trade, operating almost like a sovereign entity with the power to make laws and raise forces facing the competition, mainly the French-Canadian Northwest Company, until their merger in 1821. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Cinema 100 Winter Film Series continues on Thursday, January 15th with 9 more films, including Sentimental Value, the Iranian film It Was Just an Accident, If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, and the American 1970s classic Chinatown. Each film is shown twice on Thursdays at 3 and 6 p.m. at the Grand 22 Theater in Bismarck. More information on the entire series is available at the Cinema 100 Facebook page.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that wraps up this Wednesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, Ag Under Stress, Cattle Fraud Charges, and Lost Crop Safety Nets. That's what we'll talk about on our weekly series, A Closer Look with the Monitor. And another of our series, Tech with Peck. George Peck will join us to decode home theater buzzwords. We're looking forward to the conversation and in seeing you again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.